We have come in our study in the book of Romans to the issues of support for the conclusion that was drawn in verse 7. Verses 8 and 9 and 10 are Old Testament biblical references that address the issues that were involved in God's elective grace and the issue of the hardening of those who are outside of that electing grace. So this evening we're heading into verse 8, but when we were looking at verse 7, we were looking at the fact that Paul called on the Romans to draw a definitive conclusion to the main implication that the election of grace that preserved 7,000 Israelites from idolatry in Elijah's historical setting. That election was fundamentally a matter of grace, because he says it was an election according to the standard of grace. And then, having forced the issue of whether grace has any legal overtones at all involved in it, Paul called for this conclusion in verse 7, that what Israel was seeking for it didn't obtain, and those who were chosen obtained it, the rest were hardened, on the heels of his definitive definition of grace in relation to works, because he said in verse 6, if it's by grace, it's no longer by works, otherwise grace is no longer grace. So it's a pretty interesting thing to me that this grace issue is, was, and has always been strongly resisted. It's not only resisted by those who declare themselves to be unbelievers. Unbelievers detest the notion that God might have such a thing as an election of grace, but they detest also the issue of grace itself, whether there's any election tied to it or not. Because the concept of grace is a concept of God's independence of human demandingness. And in a very demanding world of human beings, there's not much tolerance for somebody who really doesn't have to care whether you demand things or not. I mean, I think that's really one of the reasons why our president is so hated, is because he's the first guy who's been a president who's financially independent enough that they came by him. That's just my opinion. But there's just an enormous amount of conflict in our world based on people who want to be in control of stuff, and therefore this doctrine of grace just is outside the limits as far as they're concerned. There is this resistance among unbelievers. It's almost universal. But there is also, within the group that call themselves believers, a huge block of people who really don't like grace as it is presented in the Scriptures. They love grace as they've been taught it, and as they've embraced this concept of grace that's sort of quasi-biblical. As believers, they like that part. But that resistance that is found among those who do claim to believe, that there has developed a heresy that is, even among those who say they believe, who do accept election by grace, have embraced. This election by grace is resisted even by those who claim they believe in it. And that heresy is what I call man's free will, because I don't believe the will has ever been free, not in God, not in man, not in angels, not in anybody. The will is not the highest issue of existence. The Scriptures are plentiful with the fact that it is the values of the heart and the convictions of the mind that drive the decisions of the will. The will isn't free. The will can't choose to love something it doesn't love, and it can't choose to believe something it doesn't believe. There's no freedom there. And yet we've created this notion because it seems like the bottom line in this whole issue is it's okay for God to elect by grace because he's given every man the freedom of will to believe and make himself a part of that elect. That's the conceptual doctrine of corporate election, where God just elects a block of possibles, and then he lets individuals choose whether they want to be in that block or not. That's kind of the old Church of Christ doctrine, but it's been spreading among even Baptists and others. So, in a very real sense, God has been given permission by us to be gracious as long as he leaves the reception of that grace or rejection of it up to us. We're still comfortable with election as long as we get the final say, and that's the man's free will issue. But there is even another heresy that's worse than the free will one, and that's that man has a natural desire to do what's right if he can only be told what that right is. I don't know how many missionary presentations I have heard where the missionary actually presents the idea that the people that they're going to are starving for the Word of God. They long to be told the truth. And that's just baloney. They never read Romans 2 and 3. And they're missionaries. But anyhow, the outworking of that denial of the actual fall of man into the sin back in Genesis 3 creates a mental picture of humanity that is desperately desiring to hear the Word of God so that it can embrace it. And therefore, the concept of God electing a few and hardening the rest ends up being a concept of God allowing a few to participate in grace and overtly acting in opposition to the natural desire of the rest by hardening them. So, I don't care if you want to know the truth or not. You're not one of the elect, so you just get out of here. That's the image that's created in the back of people's minds. It's just not fair for God to turn down people who are sincerely wanting to know the truth. This is a crazy picture. But nonetheless, we run into this possibility of having that picture created for us in verse 11 at the end. So that's where I want us to go this evening, is into the question of and the support for this issue of the rest were hardened. Because the superficial reading is that God elected 7,000 men in the northern kingdom to preserve from the disaster of the idolatry that was foisted upon the people in that kingdom by their kings. And it was an election of grace, which meant God didn't have to do it, but he did. And there's anything you can do about getting in it if you're not. In fact, I heard one guy tell me just recently that one of the pastors of one of the larger churches over there got up in the pulpit one Sunday and said, "If you're not chosen, you're not going." And I thought to myself, why would anybody say that, even if it's true? I mean, why would you want to stir up man's natural antagonism toward God by saying it that way? I don't understand. But anyway, verse 7 says that the conclusion that we ought to draw is that Israel was seeking, but it didn't get it. And those who were chosen did, and the rest were hardened. So it actually says Israel was seeking, didn't get it. Those who were chosen did obtain it, and the rest were hardened. It gives you kind of this superficial picture of Israel searching for this thing that the Gentiles end up getting, or the chosen or the elect end up getting, but they don't get it because they're seeking for it, but they don't get it because it's about grace. And in order to make it sure that it's about grace, God hardened the rest of them. Well, that's not what this verse is saying at all, but it gives that superficial impression just on the basis of a superficial understanding. We saw last time in our study in verse 7 that Israel's search was a perverse search. They were not seeking for a right relationship with God as he is, based on his willingness to forgive them and establish them in righteousness that was rooted in him, the righteousness of God, which is imputed to people by faith. They weren't interested in that kind of righteousness. According to Romans 10, they were seeking to establish their own. And if God wouldn't accept them on the basis of their own performance, they weren't interested in being accepted. Kind of like the knothead that I listened to one time when I was real young in the ministry. We went to a meeting that was, I knew better than to go, but I went anyway because I was curious. And they had this speaker who was heavily into the charismatic healing kind of stuff. And he had the audacity to say in his preaching that his brother was dying or something. You remember that? Anyway, the brother's situation was real bad. And so he had gone in and he had just told God, "If you're not going to heal my brother, you can forget about me being your servant." As if God would be intimidated with that. Oh, I better heal his brother. I'm going to lose his servant. This is just crazy. But there were a whole bunch of people who were buying into that. I just got up and left. Sometimes because she was with me. But anyhow, the whole thing here is that men have this goofy notion that they're in the driver's seat and they can decide what is going to be. Well, Israel wanted it to be that way. They wanted to be in the driver's seat. They wanted to establish their own righteousness so that they would have a foundation for being in the driver's seat. I really believe that one of the terrors of the controllers, and that's every legalist there is on the planet, I really believe that the underlying terror is rooted in the realization that love is a costly investment. It's going to cost you to love. I think that this whole idea of being in control is the idea of trying to preserve yourself from the costliness that's involved. For example, let's just take the big scenario, heaven and hell, the awesomeness of both of those concepts, just glory beyond imagining and disaster that you don't even want to try to imagine. Those are the scenarios that the Scripture sets before us as the inevitable future for everybody, one or the other. And so people look at that and they say, well, I want to be sure that I get in on the good side of things. So I want some kind of leverage that I can use to compel my presence in the good side, the heaven side. That way I can escape the hell side. And the whole thing that behind that is a lack of love for God or for anybody else. It's all about me. There are only two examples, aside from Jesus, in the Scriptures where men reached the level of understanding of the love of God that they actually were honestly willing to say, you know, if God wanted me to go to hell for somebody else, I'd volunteer. Because that's what love does. It volunteers to take on the most unimaginable disaster that's coming on somebody else because of love for that somebody else. Moses put himself in that picture when Israel was about to get clobbered by God for some of their wickedness, and Moses stood in the gap and said, if you won't forgive their sin, then blot me out of the book instead of them. That was a volunteerism that says, I want to be their redeemer. I want to suffer what they've got coming so they won't have to. Well, the Apostle Paul said in this book, not too many chapters prior to this one, that he was willing to be separated from Christ forever if, in fact, it would bring his brethren into the saving side of things. But most of us are not there. So if we had to choose, if we had to say, look, if God, for any reason, whether it's election of grace or any other reason, decided that I would be on the hell side of things for the accomplishment of his eternal plan, most of us would say, no, I'm not interested in volunteering for that job. When I die, I want to go to heaven. And I really, really believe that the reason why there is so much opposition to this whole concept of God being in control and this picture of people being denied by God for the thing they're seeking because they were hardened by Him is rooted in this reality. They don't want to have to love like God loves. The thing they don't understand is God will never expect that from them. Moses volunteered, but God didn't take him up on it. Paul volunteered, but God didn't take him up on it, because what they were volunteering was the love was right, but the capacity was not there. Moses could not be a redeemer for anybody that had ever sinned. Paul couldn't be a savior for the nation. He couldn't volunteer to be separated from Christ forever for their sake, because he didn't have in his humanity or in his identity in any sense the capacity to pay for that kind of sin. He couldn't do it. And God wasn't going to ask him to. God does ask us to love like He loves, but there is a degree to love that God can't ask us because we don't have the capacity for it. So I think that there's a huge amount of misunderstanding, but I don't think that misunderstanding is the root of their opposition. It's their antagonism toward God. But since we're looking at this idea of the chosen obtained it and the rest were hardened, I want us to think about that. Because the question is, what does the rest were hardened actually mean? Is the picture of verse 7 a picture of people who are eagerly seeking for something that's good? God denies them that because they're not of the elect whom he has chosen by grace, and so he gives it to the elect and he denies it to the rest that are looking for it by hardening them. Is that the picture? Well, I hope you don't say yes, because it's not. But part of the answer to that question of what does the rest were hardened actually mean, I think the first part of the answer exists in the conclusion that Paul called for in verse 7, because the first part of the conclusion we're supposed to draw is a declaration, as we've already seen, that Israel existed in a context of hyper-commitment to seeking to reject the righteousness of God as a gift in favor of establishing their own righteousness by diligent effort on their part. They were in effect saying, God, if you won't let us establish our own righteousness and then grant us heaven as a result, we're not interested in going. That's basically what they were saying. They were hyper committed to that. That's what the word in verse 7, seeking, it's an intensified form. The first problem is that intensity, because the intensity of the commitment to reject the righteousness of God in favor of righteousness as a judicial decree after evaluation is a huge problem, because the intensity means it's going to be this way or no way as far as I'm concerned. If you're not going to let me establish my own righteousness, then I'm not interested in any kind of relationship with you. I'd rather go to hell. That's the kind of attitude. And the second problem in this seeking to reject the righteousness of God in favor of their own is the absolute distinction of grace from works as God's method of justification. And what that means is, anytime anybody does anything and expects that to qualify himself for some benefit in the future, he is proving that he is committed to legal justification. That's the problem with everybody whose actions imply you owe me after I've done them. I had a fellow that I knew, was in one of the churches that I pastored, who right after I got to know him pretty well, I realized this guy never does anything for anybody, including me. That doesn't mean that he's put out a marker that he can call in later and say, I did this for you, you owe me. And all of a sudden, I didn't want him doing anything for me. Well, that's that whole issue of trying to get in control. Even my good deeds are designed to put you under my dominion. You owe me now. And when grace is introduced into the picture, where grace is absolutely separated from performance issues, then you're not acting by grace and you're not receiving grace if there's merit in the picture. If you do something for somebody with the expectation that now they owe you, you didn't do it by grace. On the other hand, if somebody gives you something and then you owe them, you're not responding to grace. Grace says, I'm going to do this because you need it, and I'm going to do it without hinging a bunch of stuff on you. You can take it or leave it. It's going to be done as a gracious thing, or it's not going to be done at all. But in the grace, there will be no hook. So I think that's the first part of the answer in the question that Israel, that which Israel was seeking for, it did not obtain. Because what it was seeking for was a way to put a hook into the control issue so that I can decide how my life's going to run. And we do not escape this by becoming believers. How many times have you and I thought, after something happened that we didn't want to happen, what did I do to bring this on? How many times have I said, what did I do to deserve this? I thought I'd done enough to deserve something better than this. That's just so much a part of the way we think. It proves to me that this depravity issue, where everything's all about me, has sunk deep into us. So the conclusion that we're to draw in this first part of the verse that answers the question, what does the rest were hardened really mean? The first conclusion that we're to draw is that Israel didn't obtain the goal of their hyper-intense pursuit of their own righteousness. Now, we know, when we stop and think about it, that hyper-intensity in establishing your own righteousness is just self-righteousness. And we all know what self-righteousness did to all those Pharisees in the first century. It made them boastful, arrogant, hateful, superior. None of those characteristics are good characteristics, and yet that's exactly what it did for them. Self-righteousness always produced that. And this means that they were hardened has its meaning tied up in this hyper-intensity of the person who refuses to function by grace. He refuses to be a recipient of it or to exercise it because he wants the works issue to be the foundations so that he can make things happen the way he wants them to. Or it's not fair. So that's part of the answer. This issue of the rest were hardened has to involve this hyper-intensity commitment. But part of the answer also is found in the quotes that Paul gives in verses 8, 9, and 10, some of which aren't even quotes. The Old Testament record regarding this issue of hardening. The actual words that Paul wrote in verse 8, just as it is written, there are several implications about that. Just as it is written means that this is no surprise. This is not a new doctrine. It's already written down back then. And that's crucial for our thinking, because this idea of the elect obtaining something by grace and the rest being hardened is not a new idea. It's not a new thought. It's an Old Testament thing. But the actual words that Paul wrote in verse 8 are not found in any single verse or set of verses in the Old Testament. It's only found when you blend some texts together. For example, the spirit of stupor. The word that's translated stupor is a word that means that you're in a condition that's similar to what we would say that you're dead to the world. Stupor means that you are so sleepy or so much asleep that nothing can affect the way you're thinking. You're just dead to the world. But the idea of being dead to the world is actually rooted in Isaiah 29:10, because that's where he talks about God pouring out a spirit of stupor over these people. But when you go to Isaiah 29:10, the idea in the text is that Israel is in such a mental condition that it's best defined by the physical phenomenon of being so sleepy that we can't even think. We're just dead to the world. I had that experience. I already mentioned it to you. But when we were coming back from Thanksgiving and we were driving into the area where the Coushatta Casino is, Hazel said, "It's 55. Meaning the speed limit, or maybe she said the speed limit's 55. My eyes were open. I was driving straight down the road, but I was completely oblivious. That's what it means, a spirit of stupor. But the idea of there being no active mental engagement for processing information and drawing legitimate conclusions, that's the idea. But in the text of Isaiah 29:10, it comes about because in that text, God has removed all ability to see. You have eyes to see but don't see, but the eyes are defined, not as eyes. In that text, the prophets of Israel were the eyes of Israel. And so you had, by the removal of legitimate prophets from the setting, you had God saying, "I've removed your eyes, now you're blind." And he wasn't talking about people that were physically blind in their eyes, because the eyes are identified as the prophets. What he was saying is the reason you can't see is because you don't have anybody telling you the truth. The prophets are not there. And then he goes on. He doesn't use the idea of ears that don't hear. In Isaiah 29, the issue is not eyes and ears, but it's eyes and heads. And the heads are identified as the seers, which is not much different than the prophets. So basically what he's saying is, look, the reason you have this spirit of stupor so that you can't think straight is because you don't have eyes or a head that enables you to think, because the eyes, which are the prophets, and the head, which is the seer, have been moved out of your, you don't have access to them. God has removed them from your presence. And as a consequence, you don't have any valid information with which to think. This is part of Paul's argument that the rest were hardened just as it is written, includes the idea that God has removed the prophets from their midst, partly because the prophets were prophets of false gods, and even Isaiah that wrote it was a legitimate prophet. But you remember in Isaiah 6 when he is volunteering to go down there and, you know, who will I send? Who will go for us? Send me. Here I am. Send me. Okay, I'll send you. I'm going to send you to this people who seeing don't see and hearing don't hear. And Isaiah says, how long is that going to go on? He said, until the land is empty. Wonderful ministry summons. I'm going to call you to be a missionary to this place on the Timbuktu, and you're not going to have one convert your whole lifetime. What a wonderful scenario. But the point that I'm trying to make is the Old Testament quote from Isaiah 29 is just a quote of a portion of the words in that verse. And in that quote, Paul is not saying the person doesn't have the capacity to think. He's saying he doesn't have the capacity to reason or think because he doesn't have the access to the information. God has removed that. And then the real reference, or the one that does actually talk about ears and eyes that see not and ears that hear not, that probably comes from Deuteronomy 29:3. And you say, well, why'd you bring up Isaiah 29:10? Because Isaiah 29:10 is where the idea of stupor comes from. There are only two times in the Septuagint of the Old Testament where that word is actually used. And one of them is in Isaiah 29, and the other is in one of the Psalms. But Paul chose that word out of Isaiah 29 to fill in this idea of the reason why people have the spirit of stupor. And one of the reasons is absence of prophetic utterance. But the other one is in Deuteronomy 29. You know, it's Isaiah 29:10, it's Deuteronomy 29:3. But I want you to consider what Moses actually was saying in Deuteronomy 29. Because it has to do with this issue of the rest were hardened. In Deuteronomy 29:1, it says, these are the words of the covenant which the Lord commanded Moses to make with the sons of Israel in the land of Moab, besides the covenant which he had made with them at Horeb. And Moses summoned all of Israel and said to them, you have seen all that the Lord did before your eyes in the land of Egypt to Pharaoh and all his servants and all his land. The great trials which your eyes have seen, those great signs and wonders. It's Deuteronomy 29:4. It's verse 4. Yet to this day, the Lord has not given you a heart to know, nor eyes to see, nor ears to hear. I've led you 40 years in the wilderness. Your clothes have not worn out on you. Your sandal hasn't worn out on your foot. You have not eaten bread, nor have you drunk wine or strong drink, in order that you might know that I am the Lord your God. When you reached this place, Sihon the king of Heshbon and Og the king of Bashan came out to meet us for battle, but we defeated them, and we took their land and gave it as an inheritance to the Reubenites. But the point that he's making is, you have seen this, but God has not given you a heart to know, nor eyes to see, nor ears to hear. Now, what does that mean? Well, number one, it means he's not hardening them down here. They apparently already are. They're already hardened, because in order to reverse the hardening, God would have to give them a heart to understand, and eyes to see, and ears to hear. So the point here is, not that God has removed the prophets and the seers from them, but the fact is, The text says the opposite of what most people think, because instead of presenting a picture of God actively blinding and making deaf, it presents a picture of God not actively opening eyes and giving hearing to the deaf. In other words, it's not a punitive imposition. It's simply a refusal to reverse something that's already there. So the major point of the text in Deuteronomy is that it presents blindness and deafness as the present, natural, uncorrected state of man. This is the natural man's automatic condition. Man can't see, can't hear, doesn't have a heart to understand. In that natural condition, there is no hope for him. He will perish. So this text raises the major question. At what point did man become blind and deaf so that it takes a special action by God to correct it? When it says in Romans 11 that the rest were hardened, the question is, when? When were the rest hardened? Well, the issue is they were hardened sometime prior to Isaiah's or Deuteronomy, Moses' statement. So the implication is this is a condition that is the natural state of things, and therefore the implication is very strong that the hardness was created in Genesis 3. When Adam sinned, the human race was plunged under a kind of hardness that enables them, or does not enable them to see, though they have eyes, and it does not enable them to hear, though they have ears. And though they have a heart, it can't understand, because they have already been subjected to the sin. Adam has plunged them into this situation. So by this blending of texts in just verse 8 of Romans 11, Paul is presenting a biblical truth that the hardening is not something that God does to people who are seeking after something. And he says, no. If I don't harden you here, you might actually make some good progress, so I'm not going to let you make that good progress when hardening. That's not the issue. The rest were hardened is a statement about the rest were in a condition of hardness that they had been in. He just didn't release them from it. And this is the whole point. When the northern kingdom and the kings of the northern kingdom forbade their people to go down to Jerusalem to worship, those people had the option of disobedience, but it would have cost them. And because they didn't want to pay the price of obedience to God, they stopped going down to Jerusalem to worship at the three required feasts and offer their sacrifices at the proper altar. They didn't want to do that. Why? Because they were already hardened. They were already into this thing about everybody's got his price. I'm not paying that kind of a price. And what we said at the beginning is still true. They didn't want to love like God loves. They wanted to put limitations on the commitments that they were going to make because they didn't want to have to pay the price that it might cost them if they really did invest in this. And that's exactly what happened when the rich young man came to Jesus and said, "Good master, what good thing can I do to inherit eternal life?" And Jesus said, "Well, you know the commandments. We talked about this one last week." What was the man's problem? He had too much money. What does that mean? Well, it doesn't mean anything if you're talking about the amount of money he has. What you're talking really about is where his competence is. Rich man who has all this money, can buy anything you want to buy, and have been doing this for all your lifetime while you've been patting yourself on the back as you've thrown these little trinkets to your neighbors and called it fulfilling the law. Where is your real confidence about the source of life? Because Jesus point blankly said that your life does not consist in the abundance of your possessions. So you either believe that or you don't. Well, he didn't. When Jesus said, "Okay, sell all your stuff and give it to the poor," he said, "No way. I will be selling my life. If I sell all my stuff and give it all away, I will have nothing. I won't be able to buy anything or sell anything. I'm not going to live that way." Without this understanding, there were thousands of people on the planet who lived that way every day because they weren't wealthy. But he thought his wealth meant I should be able to keep it and do as I please. Well, that's why Jesus said, you know, it's really hard for a rich man to get into the kingdom. Because where his trust is. Life is either from God plus no money or anything else, or it comes from money and possessions and relationships with people and all those other things. It's an either or kind of issue. So Paul is simply saying in Romans 11, the rest were hardened means the rest were having been hardened. Now, the New Testament confirms this. I want to remind you of two or three New Testament record issues. In Mark 6:52, we have the record, I believe, there of the feeding of the 5,000. This is after the feeding of the 5,000. And after the feeding of the 5,000, he sends them to get in the boat and he stays behind. And then later, he goes walking on the water to where they are and they're terrified. And it says in verse 51, he got in the boat with them, and the wind stopped, and they were greatly astonished, for they had not gained any insight from the incident of the loaves, but their heart was hardened. Now, Jesus didn't harden their hearts to keep them from understanding. Their hearts were hardened. That was the natural condition. And the feeding of the 5,000 did not penetrate the hardness to the degree that they could make the link between feeding 5,000 and the wind stopping its rage and the waters smoothing out. They couldn't make that connection in their brains. A man who could feed 5,000 people with 5 loaves and 2 fish or something like that couldn't control the weather. They couldn't make it because they had this condition called a hardened heart. Now, it says later in Mark 8, verse 17, that they had just fed 4,000 in chapter 8. And he entered the boat with his disciples, and the Pharisees came out and began to argue with him, verse 11. And he sighs deeply and he says, why does this generation seek for a sign? I'm not going to give you one. And he leaves and goes to the other side. And it says in verse 14, they had forgotten to take bread and did not have more than 1 loaf in the boat. Now, how many of them were there? There was Jesus and 12 others. Okay. So they had a loaf. Well, how many loaves do you have to feed 13 people when you can pick up 7 baskets full of leftover pieces after feeding 4,000 with 7 loaves. How many loaves do you have to feed them? So they had 1 loaf in the boat because they had forgotten to put one of those baskets of leftovers in the boat with them. And he said to them, watch out, beware the leaven of the Pharisees and the leaven of Herod. And they began to say to one another, is he talking about the fact that we don't have any bread in the boat? I mean, what's this leaven of the Pharisees and the leaven of Herod and our only having 1 loaf of the boat? What's this all about? And you know what Jesus said? Verse 17, why do you discuss the fact that you have no bread? Do you not yet see or understand? Do you have a hardened heart? Having eyes, don't you see? Having ears, don't you hear? And don't you remember when I broke the 5 loaves? And he asked them, you know. But the point here is this. The hardness of the heart, the inability to see, the inability to hear, is the natural condition of the men. And the fact that they were disciples of Jesus, the fact that they were believers in Jesus, had not solved that problem. And then there's another text over in John chapter 12 that is extremely enlightening in relation to this. Because in John chapter 12, it says in verse 37, though he had performed so many signs before them, yet they were not believing in him, that the word of Isaiah the prophet might be fulfilled, which he spoke, Lord, who has believed our report, and to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? For this cause they could not believe, because Isaiah said again, he has blinded their eyes and hardened their heart, lest they see with their eyes, perceive with their heart, and be converted, and I heal them. Now, it says these things Isaiah said because he saw his glory. The interesting thing about this statement is that Jesus was saying the reason they couldn't believe was because God had blinded and had hardened. But those verbs are both perfect tense verbs. It's not saying that this hardening was an act that Jesus took or that God took at this particular time. He's saying it's an act that took place way back, and the results are still continuing. In other words, Paul's doctrine of the hardness of man's heart, the inability to see spiritual truth, the inability to hear and understand spiritual truth, is an inability that was imposed at the beginning. It was when they came under the dominion of sin in Genesis 3 by the action of their father Adam that they had this hardness imposed upon them, and from then on it was Katie bar the door. It was all downhill from there unless grace intervened. So this is the whole idea. When Paul says in Romans 11 until this very day, he says, just as it's written, God gave them a spirit of stupor, eyes to see not, ears to hear not, down to this very day. That statement means this has been the standard until today. This is the way it is. Men are hardened. They have eyes that can't see and ears that can't hear because God has given them this spirit of stupor. But when did he give it? Back when he fulfilled the word to Adam that in the day you eat thereof you shall surely die. And so these New Testament verses, when we combine them with, for example, Isaiah 6:10, where God says, I want you to go and I want you to prophesy to this people till the cities are empty. They're not going to listen. They're not going to see. I want you to declare it, but it's not going to cause any converts. When you combine that with the fact of Genesis 3, men have been blind and deaf from the beginning. So the picture of Romans 11 is not that they had this group of aggressively seeking people for something that's good, and God saying, no, I'm not interested in that. I'm going to harden you so that you don't get it. That's not the picture. The picture is in their hardness, they're pursuing an intense desire to establish their own righteousness, and God simply doesn't intervene. They're intensely pursuing that. But when you pursue something that is impossible for you to obtain, you will not obtain it. So they were seeking for it with intensity, but what they were seeking for was self-righteousness, and they didn't get that. But the righteousness that would lead to acceptance by God, those who were chosen obtained that because the choosing was God's initiation of grace into the situation. He stuck grace in there. And so the point is this. Rather than being God blocking people who want to know the truth, the picture is that it requires a special restorative action by God to fix a just action that was imposed in Genesis 3 on the basis of the warning. When God responded to Adam's sin with justice. And the day you eat thereof, you shall surely die. People say, well, why didn't God intervene when this temptation was going on? Well, if he had intervened, that would have been a gracious thing. And grace can't be compelled, and you can't explain God's choices about grace. Nobody can, except God, because it's beyond our comprehension. The fact is, God was involved in a plan to bring about a kingdom of righteousness, peace, and joy. And it's going to take about 7,000 years of human history to bring that to pass. And so he initiated these things. And the only thing that can stop the imposition or the consequences of hardness, the consequences of justice applied to wickedness, the only thing that can stop that is for God to intervene in grace. So the issue of special restorative action is rooted in the grace of God. It can't be demanded. It can't be merited. Therefore, since grace has become the focus, since John the Baptizer came on the scene, since grace has been the focus from there in the theology of the whole New Testament, the focus of the gospel, the salvation that's presented by it in its entirety, is rooted in a total rejection by God of works, because if he doesn't reject works, he has to put you under law. If he has to put you under law, you're sunk. So, in order to keep us from all being sunk, he intervenes with grace. It's only the hyper-egotistical men who insist on being allowed to control their own destinies by their own choices. That's egotistical, and God resists the proud. The gospel will not have an impact on them unless it's accompanied by a special gracious action of deliberate divine insistence. And again, as we've said many times, the Apostle Paul wrote this out of his own experience. He was well on his way down the road of hardness of heart, inability to see, inability to hear, and Jesus just got in front of him on the road to Damascus and said, enough. Why? Because you're a chosen vessel of mine. I've got a job for you to do, and it doesn't include you going to hell when you die. I'm going to stop you right here. And so he did. And I really believe that the rest of these Old Testament references that we'll look at in the future, Lord willing, next weekend, but simply reinforce the fact that hardness was imposed by the fall. And because of that, it takes God's special gracious action to reverse it. But he takes it on the basis of grace, because otherwise it can't be reversed. Works condemns you. Grace delivers you.